We go now to the gold standard of weird. It's a movie from 1999 that's being re-released on DVD by the Criterion Collection. For our latest home video recommendation, film critic Bob Mondello is here to remind us what it's like being John Malkovich.
It's weirdness run amok. Puppeteer John Cusack gets a filing job in an office building where the floor he works on, 7.5, isn't quite tall enough for him to stand, but does have a perk, as he tells co-worker Catherine Keener.
There's a tiny door in my office, Maxine. It's a portal, and it takes you inside John Malkovich. You see the world through John Malkovich's eyes, and then after about 15 minutes, you're spit out into a ditch on the side of the New Jersey Turnpike.
Sounds great. Who's John Malkovich?
When these two decide to charge cash for entry to Malkovich's mind, things get complicated, especially when John Malkovich finds out and takes the trip himself, the ultimate exercise in narcissism.
Malkovich.
Screenwriter Charlie Kaufman and director Spike Jonze have strange sensibilities, and the DVD's commentary track by Michel Gondry, who made Kaufman's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind,
I'm sure Spike had the crush on Catherine,
is a little strange too.
You have another commentary track than mine, that's going to be the only one. It's a disaster.
There's also a documentary about puppetry, a Malkovich interview conducted by, of all people, comedian John Hodgman, and Spike Jonze even finds a way to make an extra about photos he took on the set feel odd.
It is 2028, and we're looking back at a 30-year anniversary of being John Malkovich for New Format's This Chip That Gets Put Into the Back of Your Head, and you just watch the movie in 1/2 of a second. And so we look at all these photos from 30 years ago when we made the film. This is Vince Land Day.
Mostly, though, being John Malkovich is worth watching for itself, an enduringly quirky comedy with grand metaphysical implications that you can just watch because it's a real trip. I'm Bob Mondello.
I did it! I made him move his arm! And I made him talk, sort of. It's just a matter of practice. Before Malkovich is nothing more than another puppet hanging next to my work table.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Dave Decker has a problem. And as a creative promoter of tourism, he has decided that the solution to the problem is to turn it to his own advantage. Mr. Decker is executive director of the Tri-State Tourism Council, which covers rural parts of Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois, and where evidently cell phone service is pretty bad and the internet can be slow. So Mr. Decker is pitching tech-free vacations. He joins us now from Dubuque, Iowa, on a cell phone, so I have to ask you first, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you fine.
In the city, the reception is adequate, you say?
You bet.
Now, make your sales pitch to us. Why do I want to go on a vacation where I can't get any cell phone reception or internet access?
When I was at Christmas this last year, let me tell you this quick story.
Mm-hmm.
I look around the kids between 6 and 16 years old. If they're not opening a gift, they're on an electronic gadget. That was on my wife's side of the family. The following weekend at my side of the family, I confiscate all cell phones because I don't want to see everybody being engaged with their electronic instead of watching the others open gifts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example. Are you tired of seeing the kids attached to an electronic device all the time? How about a getaway with a spouse? If they're always using that phone and that gadget while they're home, isn't a getaway to get away from all of it?
So you're saying if we take a vacation to the tri-state area, this particular tri-state area being Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois, we don't have to confiscate these wireless devices. They just won't work.
You know, 95% of the places, they will work. What happens is you get in the outlying areas. We are in the driftless region, which means the glaciers didn't hit our area. So we've got very high peaks and low valleys. So a lot of the places you'll be doing fine, like, say, in the Chicagoland area, in the St. Louis area with Verizon or Sprint, for example, but you get out here and these low-lying areas, you won't have cell phone reception.
So are the bed and breakfast there actually advertising tech-free vacations?
We are getting some that are advertising the unplugged getaway, and some of them are not having television. Irish Hollow in Galena, Illinois, promotes no TV. When you come out there, and this is a very, very nice place. We're not talking that they can't afford it. But when you get out there, they want you to get away from it all. And they don't have televisions in the room. They will ask if you'd like to leave your cell phones and your iPads at the desk. They want you to read, hike, bike, walk, bird watching, things like this that you typically don't do the other 5 days a week when you're, you know, living the city life, if you will. So.
And have you come up with a slogan that at least some of the places can join in with here in the making the best of a bad thing?
Well, I think unplug has kind of become, you know, unplug and get away from it. And that's, to me, that's the slogan, is we want to get away from it all. I just get frustrated with this situation today where people just can't leave it. I mean, you know, reward them. Hey, if I was a bed and breakfast owner, if you make 24 hours, I'll give you a free bottle of wine. You know, can you do it? You know, here's the challenge. The gauntlet has been laid.
Any reaction from visitors so far?
You know, it's been really good for the Irish Hollow. I know that they have had no resistance to the no televisions in the room, and they are really pleased with the fact that people are wanting to come and feel how it would have been 100 years ago. Maybe I'm old. Maybe it's just me. Maybe the other generations don't see it that way, but I do think there's a wonderful time to decompress and just, you know, get away from things.
Well, Mr. Decker, thanks a lot for talking with us about it.
Today. You bet.
That's Dave Decker, who is executive director of the Tri-State Tourism Council, which covers parts of Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. He spoke to us from Dubuque.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's a sign of how firmly entrenched Jamie Dimon is at JPMorgan Chase. The bank lost at least $2 billion in just a few weeks of failed trades.
The news came out just before the annual shareholder meeting in Tampa. But Dimon, really one of the few giants of Wall Street still standing after the financial crisis, turned aside a bid to curtail his power.
He came into the meeting as JPMorgan's chairman of the board and CEO. That is the loose equivalent, in government terms, of having the same person as both Speaker of the House and President. Dimon kept his titles, even though, as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, he faces a vocal group clamoring for change.
One of the biggest bones of contention has to do with whether J.P. Morgan is fighting regulations that passed after the financial crisis. Jamie Dimon says he supports 70% to 80% of what's known as the Dodd-Frank financial reform law.
We all want better, smarter, and stronger regulation that is based on facts and analysis. Second, as I wrote my chairman's letter, and I quote, we agree with the intent of the Volcker Rule.
The Volcker Rule would put limits on a bank's ability to trade its own funds, limiting, in essence, both the risk and the rewards on those trades. Dimon told the audience of more than 500 shareholders that he supports some limits, but not all. He argued the bank is also regulating itself. Those failed trades, he said, violated the bank's own rules about risk. This response did not satisfy at least one longtime shareholder. Reverend Seamus Finn is with the Missionary Oblates of Mary Immaculate and is a shareholder activist.
Up until now, we've basically been getting, you know, all sorts of efforts on their part to thwart the major piece of legislation that was put in place, not to make it better. So we would like them to take the opportunity to make it better. Thus far, I don't think they've been doing that.
I think the takeaway is that Wall Street's already driven our economy into a ditch once. And I don't think that the financial sector has learned anything from the crisis.
That is Lisa Lindsley, director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. Lindsley presented a proposal to strip Dimon of his chairman title and give it to someone outside of bank management. That proposal failed, along with several other measures put forward by shareholders. Lindsley noted most of the votes were cast before the revelation of the big losses last week. Her proposal still won 40%, which is much higher than in previous years.
Shareholders are coming around to that idea.
Paul Hodgson is a senior research associate with GMI Ratings. He says separating the leadership roles helps moderate the kinds of risks that banks take.
If the CEO's the boss of the board, as well as of the executive management, then you don't have any kind of balance of power. And, you know, this country is supposed to be about checks and balances. And if we can't institute that in corporate arenas, then we'll get the kinds of mistakes that we saw being made last week.
He says now over half of Fortune 500 firms have separate chairmen and CEOs, up from only a fifth of companies just a few years ago. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Rupert Murdoch's trusted protege, Rebecca Brooks, is facing criminal charges in Britain. Brooks, her husband, and four other people were charged today with interfering with a police investigation into the phone hacking scandal. Brooks ran Murdoch's UK arm, News International, until she stepped down last year. As Vicky Barker reports, these are the first criminal charges to be filed since police reopened their investigation in early 2011.
In late March, police gave British prosecutors the files on their ongoing investigation into alleged illegal phone hacking at the News of the World and at another Murdoch tabloid, The Sun. The documents identified seven people who may have conspired to pervert the course of justice, a serious crime here. Today, in a rare televised statement, senior prosecutor Alison Levitt announced the result of her deliberations.
I have concluded that in relation to all suspects except the seventh, there is sufficient evidence for there to be a realistic prospect of conviction.
Levitt said it was also clear that a full criminal trial would be in the public interest. But British viewers and listeners already knew that. True to her tabloid roots, Rebecca Brooks had leaked the news minutes before the official announcement. Charged along with Brooks, her horse trainer husband, Charlie Brooks, and four of her former staffers at News International, her assistant, her chauffeur, her head of security, and a security staffer. A second security official, that seventh suspect, will not be prosecuted. Among other things, Brooks is accused of removing seven boxes of material from the News International archive and concealing documents, computers, and other electronic equipment from the police last July. That's when Brooks stepped down as chief executive of News International and Rupert Murdoch closed down the News of the World. Speaking after reporting to a London police station, Brooks seemed angriest that people who had worked for her had been targeted. Unfairly, she insisted.
Even News International's harshest critics can't wish to see today people with no involvement of the central issues being treated like this and being involved like this.
She called the decision to prosecute weak and unjust and said the upcoming trial would be a waste of public money. Charlie Brooks accused police and prosecutors of a witch hunt against his wife. He felt confident of getting a fair trial, he said.
But I have grave reservations that my wife can ever get a fair trial, given the huge volume of biased commentary that she is constantly subjected to. We will fight this in court.
In fact, the minute the charges were announced, Britain's army of media pundits fell silent. Once criminal charges are brought in the UK, the case is sub judice. Coverage cannot be seen in any way to be prejudicing the outcome of a trial, as Liz Howell of London's City University Journalism School explains.
Most of us just go completely stum after criminal charges come out.
So how is this going to affect coverage of the phone hacking scandal?
I am not going to speak about the phone hacking scandal for exactly the reasons that we've just talked about.
There has been no comment either from Prime Minister David Cameron, a close friend of the couple. Their first court appearance is scheduled for June 13th. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. In Vermont, the last sap in the spring maple sugaring season isn't good for much. It's too dark and strong to use for commercial maple syrup. But long ago, that late season sap was used in a potent beer. Steve Zind of Vermont Public Radio reports on efforts to revive this old farm tradition.
In the 1970s, Vermont musician John Castle recorded a locally popular song about sap beer.
Old man with a sugar in through, and what can you be looking for here? Well, son, now we're gonna start brewing sap beer.
Ironically, you would have been hard-pressed to find any sap beer to drink by then. It had taken its place among obsolete farm traditions like milking by hand. In a 1992 interview with the Vermont Folklife Center, the late Edgar Dodge described how sap beer was made on the Vermont farm where he grew up.
Well, I can tell you that you would take the last run of the sugar in operation, you know what I'm talking about? About get down where you can kind of taste the leaves in it, that sort of thing, yeah.
Dodge said that leafy-tasting sap would be boiled down about halfway to syrup. Farmers added hops, yeast, a little sugar, or maybe some raisins, and put it up in a barrel in the cellar. Folklorist Greg Sherrow says sap beer represents a time when farm families got just about everything they needed from their land.
When you ask farmers about farming in that era, they say, well, we lived less on income than lack of expense. So in that context, every possible resource was utilized.
A glass of sap beer was cool relief after a day of hot farm work. As Edgar Dodge remembered, it was brought up out of the cellar just about the time the first hay was cut.
And this would be fit to drink about the first of hand, which in those days was 4th of July. You started haying 4th of July.
Any amateur brewer knows there's some guesswork and mystery involved in beer making, and that applied in spades to sap beer. Dodge said you couldn't be sure until you tasted it whether the final product would be drinkable or...
junk. Stringy. Nobody could drink it. Cut it off with a pair of shears. That sort of thing.
But when it didn't take a pair of shears to serve it up, what came out of the barrel was a strong brew.
And I don't think the man ever lived. He could drink 2 8-ounce glasses and walk 10 minutes later. I don't believe so. So that was sap beer. I doubt if there's a barrel of sap beer in the state of Vermont today.
Maybe not when Dodge reminisced about it 20 years ago. But there is a spark of renewed interest in the old refreshment, thanks to a couple of Vermont microbreweries.
This is this year's batch of Maple Triple.
This month, Sean Lawson won a silver ribbon at the prestigious World Beer Cup for the sap beer he bottles under his label Lawson's Finest Liquids. Lawson's sap beer is similar to the traditional drink. He ages it in a barrel, and what comes out is high in alcohol content with a strong maple flavor. And it's different every year.
It's a product of the season and the place and the sugar maker and their trees. So every year my batch is a little bit different. That's part of the fun.
Last year, Lawson produced 375 hand-numbered and signed bottles of sap beer. This year's brew is just about ready. For NPR News, I'm Steve Zind in Braintree, Vermont.